Ethan, I've read most of your book. I'm not finished with it. And when I was reading it, it reminded me a lot of when I was about 9 years old and I read Isaac Asimov's Intelligent Man's Guide to the Universe. Because he and you did something very similar in the sense that you both take on all the major discoveries of cosmology and related physics and talk about not just facts about how the universe works, but how it came to be known. And the difference between your books, of course, is that Asimov is, 40 years out of date and not very useful today. So I think it's a great book. I strongly recommend people read it. We'll have a link on our webpage, on the Iconicast webpage to it. But while I was reading it, one of the things that struck me as really a great example of, well, let me just say this. I think we have a one of our goals of our of this podcast and a lot of the one goal of your blogging and my blogging is to connect with people who are interested in science and help people to understand not just the latest science news, but how to think more about science like a scientist might. And one of the problems we have is that people don't fully, I think, grok or understand the scientific method and how science actually progresses. For example, I've often seen people mention that when a theory encounters a fact that contradicts a theory, you throw the theory out. You often hear this from creationists. Creationists have all kinds of examples of facts that don't match evolutionary theory, so therefore evolutionary theory is all wrong. But we also know as scientists that when we have a theory that's really strong and we come up to a fact that doesn't match it, it may be appropriate to roll over the fact. It might be appropriate to question the fact itself. Can neutrinos really go faster than the speed of light? Our theory says no. Turns out it's an instrument error. And I was reading your description of after the discovery of Uranus, what people did. They had this a theory of gravity and how planets go around the sun. They had Newton and Kepler, and then they had Uranus, and Uranus wasn't behaving properly. And this led to the first time, I think, that a new planet was discovered in the way that it was. That story of Uranus and what happened after those observations is to me a really fantastic story. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, so thanks for having me on, first off. And I agree with a lot of what you said about science and what people don't understand or appreciate very often is, you're right, the best scientific theory will look at the full suite of evidence that's out there. We'll take a look at absolutely everything that's relevant to a phenomenon or a set of phenomena or anything under that theory's purview, and we'll try to explain every single fact in terms of one single simple unifying theory that takes care of all of it. Now, there's going to be a limit to the range of validity of every theory you run into. At some point, at small scales, at early times, on large scales, every theory will break down if you press it to a high enough precision. And that's outstanding. That is not a flaw in science. That's a feature of how we can discover new things, deeper truths, or extend the range of validity of our theories to where they didn't work previously. So, what you talk about, what I talked about in my book, and this is one of my favorite stories about scientific discovery, is if you take a look back at, say, the 1600s, when we were discovering heliocentrism, the motion of the planets in ellipses around the sun, when Newton was putting out his laws of gravitation that described everything in the known universe, the solar system, the phenomena on Earth, etc. This was a really revolutionary time. There were old ideas and old theories that simply lack the predictive power. You can make something in, say, a geocentric framework that explains the orbits of the planets around, through the sky in just as good a precision as this model, but it's not predictive. If you discover another planet, it can only be descriptive. It's not going to be prescriptive. It won't tell you, here's how this new planet is going to move. You can describe, oh yeah, here's how this planet moves. Here's the equant, here's the deferent, here's all my geocentric parameters. but it's not predictive. It lacks that power that we associate with a good scientific theory. When we discovered Uranus in 1781, this was exciting for a lot of reasons. Not only was it the first new planet ever discovered with a telescope, but it was the first time that we had a new object in our solar system to test Kepler's and Newton's laws with. And what we discovered was, as we observed it, you know, everyone knows Kepler's first law, that planets move in ellipses around the sun. But what people less commonly are aware of is Kepler's second law, which tells you that planets sweep out equal areas in equal amounts of time. If you were to take the arc that a planet sweeps out over time and you were to draw a nice, almost a triangle, like a portion of the ellipse that it sweeps out, where you would connect the planet to the sun, you would sweep that out and make that little bit of area. Any amount of time you chose, regardless of what that orbit looks like, of what the shape of that ellipse is, you should get equal areas in equal amount of time for any orbiting object. So when you observe Uranus, it turned out that it didn't appear to obey Kepler's laws. For the first 20 years, it seemed to be moving faster than Kepler's laws predicted. It was sweeping out too much area. And so people said, well, you know, let's keep observing this. Maybe something's wrong with these early observations. And then over the next 20 years, it actually started to move at the right speed. So people said, oh, okay, this is good. Probably those early first 20 years of observations weren't great. But then over the next 20 years, the third 20 years, it started to slow down. So it was moving too fast, and then at the right speed, and then too slow. And this was a big problem. There were people who considered throwing Newton's laws out. But there was another explanation, one that a few theorists worked on. One was John Couch Adams of the UK, and one was Urbain Le Verrier of France. What they theorized is, what if the reason Uranus is moving at these too fast, just right, and too slow speeds isn't because of a flaw in the law of gravity? What if Newton's laws are just absolutely perfect, and there's another mass farther out beyond Neptune, beyond Uranus, maybe something that we call Neptune today, that gives an extra tug on it? What if it pulls Uranus in that direction of motion too quickly to start? And then when it's lined up in roughly the same line of sight, it tugs on it, but we don't see it. And then when Uranus passes it, Neptune is moving slower, being an outer planet, and so it pulls it backwards, which would cause it to move too fast, and then just right, and then too slow. And it was Le Verrier who made such a good prediction that he sent where this planet should be, if it exists, to the observatory in Berlin, and within 1 degree of where he predicted it should be, the very first night they looked for it, they found it. And that's how we discovered the planet Neptune. Now, shortly after that, people were looking at the planet Mercury, because Mercury also had a problem with its orbit. If you took a look at the Sun and Mercury, you don't get a perfect ellipse because there are other planets in the solar system that tug on it. So an ellipse does what we call it precesses, which is basically, if you can imagine an ellipse where the Sun is close to one side, and then that ellipse starts to rotate in space. That's what precession is. Now, the rate of precession was incredibly slow. It was 575 arc seconds per century. So that's about a sixth of a degree every 100 years. But we'd been observing it really well since about 1600, since the time of Tycho Brahe. So for almost 300 years by this point, we had good observations of Mercury's position and how its orbit precesses. And what we found was 575 is the right number. What we had calculated, even with Neptune there, was 532 was what Newton's theory predicted. So the first idea was, well, there must be another new planet interior to Mercury. And they even named it. They called it Vulcan. And there was a big search for Vulcan. People fried their optics on their telescopes, looking too close to the sun, hoping to find this Vulcanoid planet. And it doesn't exist. Right? Spoiler alert. Vulcan doesn't exist. There's no planet interior to Mercury in our solar system.
But I have seen it in movies.
But yeah. Got destroyed, though. So.
Right. Yeah. Well, is that before or after the Romulan invasion?
Right. That was...
right. So that's a different Vulcan. But what happens is it's not actually due to a new planet. It turned out we needed a new theory of gravity. This was where Einstein's theory of general relativity came in to save the day. And it turns out that Venus and Earth actually have a little bit extra precession to their perihelion due to the general relativistic effects of the sun. But we weren't good enough to measure Venus and Earth's orbit to that precision that early on. So it turns out that, yes, sometimes your observations are problematic. Sometimes your theory has reached the end of its limits of what its range of validity is. But in all cases, the scientific method is the same. You use the best theories you have to tell you what you should be looking for. Sometimes you find it and sometimes you don't. Sometimes you have to extend your theory. Sometimes you need to look outside of what you're currently looking for. And sometimes you need to consider other options, even if they're unpalatable. But in every case, it's the collection of more and better data, considering the full suite of possibilities, even the unlikely ones, and looking for ways to tell those possibilities apart, which is how science advances forward and how our knowledge of the universe in general moves forward.
Back to Uranus and Neptune, even the discovery of Uranus didn't really satisfy the question of what was affecting its orbit. And that was what led to the interest in searching for Pluto. And Pluto might have been accidentally placed as being the explanation for the perturbance of the orbit of Uranus. Isn't that right?
Well, it wasn't for... Okay, so you have to remember, whenever you're making observations, it's very easy to fool yourself into thinking your observations are better than they are, which is to say it's very hard to accurately estimate your errors in measurement. It's very hard to estimate all of your uncertainties and all of your unknowns. This is a problem that showed up in, as you referenced, in the faster-than-light neutrinos phenomenon from a few years ago. And it's something that comes up a lot, where you say, okay, here are all my known sources of error. Here's everything that I think of that could be wrong, that could be throwing me off. And you tend to stop after a certain amount of time. After you have all the sources you can identify that sound reasonable to you, you say, well, that's what I'm doing. That's what I've got. What people didn't realize is our estimates for the masses of Uranus and Neptune were not as good as we thought they were. Our estimates, therefore, for what should this orbit be doing was off. And so people said to themselves, like, well, there should be an extra planet out beyond Neptune to explain the motions of these outer worlds. There should be a planet X or a planet 9 or something else that causes an extra gravitational tug. This shows up over and over again. In the 1950s and 60s, people thought that the sun couldn't be as good of a sphere as it actually is, that it had to be an oblate spheroid, just like Earth bulges around the equator and is compressed around the poles due to its rotation. People thought the sun had to be oblate like that because they thought that that precession of Mercury was off by about 5 arcseconds per century from what general relativity predicted. So either you have to modify your theory of gravity, and so Bob Dickey at Princeton came up with the Brans-Dickey theory of gravity, or you would have to have an oblate sun, right? A solar oblateness that was greater than that. Well, it turned out that the whole solar oblateness problem was due to a bad measurement of the sun, that people measured solar oblateness where there wasn't any. And for the whole Planet X thing, a planet out beyond Uranus to explain its orbit, there's no problem with Uranus's orbit. There's no problem now with general relativity in the orbits of any of the 8 planets that we have. So it's very difficult to be honest with yourself about your uncertainties in your measurements. And I feel like that leads to a lot of misunderstandings, both among scientists themselves and also among the general public in their trust and understanding of science, because they think that, well, this means anything could be wrong, or everything that science says could be wrong. And that's not true. There's a limit to what could be wrong, because we have supreme confidence from many lines of evidence in a great many phenomena. Now, it's true that one observation that's robust, that's repeatable, that really shows this is not what we think it is, this is not consistent with the theory, it can overturn a theory, but it won't overturn the theory over the range where that theory's been shown to be valid, for one. And second, the way you're going to overturn that theory, the way you're going to extend that theory and go beyond what you previously knew, the only process that's going to lead you there is by doing more science, is by doing more experiments, gathering more data, and coming up with a better theory that encompasses the old one and extends it to include and cover these new observations.
I think it's interesting that there's a kind of a historical hierarchy of theories explaining the universe, beginning with, well, not beginning with Newton, but getting up to Newton and then getting into relativity and different kinds of relativity and so on. And it seems to me that the way that those ideas were incubated and eventually demonstrated or tested is also correlated with an increase in the physical scale at which we're able to measure things and observe things. At the time that Newton and Kepler were working, there was no concept of there being multiple galaxies. It wasn't until you had the concept of multiple galaxies that a lot of other things about how the universe works could even be evaluated or understood.
You know, that's absolutely right. And this is something I also discuss in the context of my book is, you know, early in the 20th century, there was actually a big debate about whether there were other galaxies, whether those spirals in the sky were galaxies, or whether they were just a new type of nebula, spiral nebulae, within our own galaxy. And that possibility to us today sounds absolutely crazy, but it's very important to recognize that if you looked at the full suite of evidence that was available at the time, and they had like different points, like some of them seemed to support that actually these things were within our galaxy, and others of them seem to support, no, they were well beyond the galaxy. The most, just to give you two of them, one was these objects were found to move incredibly fast, much faster than anything else we knew of within our galaxy. If we look at the other stars from their red and blue shifts, we can measure how fast they're moving relative to the sun. And most of them move on the order of tens of kilometers a second. Some of the faster ones will move at like 100 kilometers a second. But when you look at these spirals, they're moving at 300, 600, 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 kilometers a second. They're moving way faster than anything else in our galaxy. So much so that you would conclude if these were in our galaxy, they would become gravitationally unbound. They've reached what we call escape velocity. They wouldn't stay within our galaxy. So therefore, it stands to reason that at least some of them are probably beyond our own galaxy now. But on the other hand, there was a piece of evidence that these spirals, the face-on ones, appear to be rotating. They appear to be rotating over time, over like decade time scales. And if you look at how much the stars in them appear to move over 10, 20 years or so, you say, well, if these are really far away, if these are hundreds of thousands or millions of light years away, then they'd be rotating faster than the speed of light. And you can't do that in relativity. Well, it turns out one of these observations was correct and the other one was spurious. The way we figured that out is by doing more and better science. It turned out the galaxies, they are galaxies, by the way, so spoiler for anyone who hasn't read the book. It turns out that the galaxies aren't rotating. It turns out that that was something that was right at the limits of what the observer, a man named Van Manen, could see. And he thought he saw rotation and he recorded it. and it wasn't there. And it turned out that that was at the limit of what he could see. And that's what I mean about having to be honest about your errors, about your uncertainties. It's very difficult to do. So that's something we have to be aware of, especially with new results that are sort of right at the limit of what we can detect. Those are the ones you should be most skeptical of in any scientific endeavor.
Well, it's interesting, too, that I didn't know this until I read your book. I don't remember the details, but it wasn't until the first actual photograph of a galaxy that we understood certain things about them, as opposed to just looking with your eye.
Well, that's absolutely true. You have to remember, when you look with your eye, you know, there's a reason that your videos play at like 30 frames a second or 24 or 60, depending on what you're doing. It's because we don't gather light continuously. We take light and it comes into our eyes, and our eyes, you know, basically do this image processing for us through our nerves and our brain, and they construct what appears to be a continuous image in our head. But our eyes are only collecting photons, you know, in clumps. It's like, oh, it stimulates the nerve and my brain puts it together, and it stimulates the nerves and my brain puts it together. And when you have a camera with a shutter that you can leave open, all of a sudden you're not gathering light for just a fraction of a second and that's your image. What you're doing is you're adding light up over time and over time and over time. There are all sorts of things that we've only been able to learn thanks to this ability to gather light for longer periods of time. This not only has led to us to understand more things about our galaxy and about nebulae within our galaxy and beyond, but also, if you remember in the 1990s, that's how we discovered how many galaxies there are in the universe at all. That's how we took the Hubble Deep Field images, is we said, I'm going to leave my shutter on my telescope open. It took a total of 342 images on the same patch of sky, imaging for hours and hours and hours and hours of just black nothingness. It's a very risky thing to do with a lot of observing time. And what they found were thousands and thousands of galaxies. If you take a look at the deepest exposure we've taken today, the extreme deep field, and you say, if we look at all of the galaxies we found in this tiny patch of sky, and you extrapolate that over the entire sky, you find that there are at least 170 billion galaxies in our universe. And all of this would be impossible if it weren't for the development of photography and the concept of gathering light over long periods of time and adding it all together to produce a more developed, more detailed image than you can see with your eye alone.
I wanted to get back to the rotation of the galaxies, just because of the fact that there is a concept in there that a lot of people had a hard time understanding, and that is because, in, say, in a solar system, when an object is orbiting the sun, the farther out that it is by necessity, the slower it's actually going to go. But galaxies seem to hold their shape, especially spiral galaxies, and you had alluded earlier to the rotation of the galaxies, but there's got to be some explanation for how spiral galaxies manage to maintain their shape considering their mass. And that somehow led to the idea of the process that there's some dark matter out there that helps shape the galaxies. Can you go through that a little bit?
For some reason, people tend to be skeptical of dark matter. And I get it. It's an odd-sounding concept, right? What are the odds that, you know, when you take a look at a phenomenon, you see it's this entirely new type of substance rather than, you know, look, we've had problems with the law of gravity before. How do we know we're not just having one again? And that's a legitimate concern. I mean, maybe we are. Gravity has had problems throughout the years and will likely continue to have problems. This came about, interestingly enough, dark matter first came up in the 1930s. So if you take a look back into the annals of history, there was this Swiss astronomer named Fritz Zwicky. And what Zwicky was doing was he was doing extragalactic astronomy. Now that we knew we had galaxies beyond the Milky Way, we found that they were clustered together at some points in space. And the closest ultra-rich cluster of galaxies to us on Earth is the Coma Cluster. This is about 300 million light years away, a little bit more than that, a little over 300 million light years away. There are thousands of Milky Way-sized galaxies in there, whereas our Milky Way galaxy might have, you know, around a trillion solar masses worth of material. We're talking quadrillions of masses of material, of solar masses of material in this Coma Cluster. And what Zwicky did was he took two pieces of knowledge that he had. He said, okay, look, on the one hand, we think we understand how stars work, right? If I see light coming from these galaxies and I know how far away they are and I measure how much light is coming from them, then I can tell you how much mass there is in stars in all of these galaxies. All right, the reason, as you said, that we know that the planets move in ellipses around the sun and that the faster planets like Mercury, the closer planets like Mercury move faster and the farther planets like Neptune move slower is because all the mass in the solar system is concentrated in our sun. And that's true. 99.8% of the mass of the solar system is in the sun. About half of the rest is in Jupiter, and all of the other rest is in everything else combined. So if you look at that, you'll say, yeah, that's what's going on. Well, if you assume, because of that, that the galaxies are all made out of stars, then great. You measure the starlight coming from galaxies. You can figure out how much mass has to be in there. And so you do that. You measure all the starlight coming from all the galaxies in this cluster, and you say how much mass is there, and you get a number. And then you say, aha, but I have another way to measure mass because I know the laws of gravity. I know Einstein's general relativity. I know Newton's law of gravitation. So if I look at how fast these individual galaxies move around in the cluster, and I know this cluster is bound together, right? There's a theorem that tells you how this works. It's called the Virial theorem. So if you measure this speed, you can figure out how much mass is in this cluster. So now we've got two different ways to measure mass. You've got all the mass due to starlight, and that's one number, and you've got all the mass due to gravitation, and that's another number. And if the way we thought galaxies and stars worked was all there was, then these two numbers would match. As it turns out, they don't match, and they don't match by a factor, according to Zwicky, of 160. Now, it turned out that we actually didn't know how stars work, and now we know better, and that 160 turns out to be more like a factor of 50. But that's still really bad. There's 50 times as much mass as we would expect due to stars. So we say, okay, look, there's all sorts of other things this could be, right? Stars aren't the only form of mass there are. There's black holes, there's planets, there's gas, there's dust, there's plasma, there's all of this stuff. Well, you fast forward to the present day, we know how to quantify all that stuff. And that'll get you about 7 or 8 times as much matter as the stars. But 7 or 8 is not going to get you up to 50. There has to be something else, some new form of matter in there. In order to keep these things gravitationally bound. The whole thing about spiral galaxies is when we watch them rotate, that is, you look at the edge-on ones, and the light on one side will be blue-shifted because it's rotating towards you, and the light on the other side will be red-shifted because it's rotating away from you. You know, just like if you imagine looking at a record edge-on or, you know, turntables, mm-hmm. The side moving towards you, that's going to be blue shifted. The side moving away from you, that'll be red shifted. That's what this spiral galaxy does. Instead of rotating with the inner parts going faster and the outer parts going slower, everything rotates at the same linear speed. So the inner parts might move at 300 kilometers a second, and the outer parts also move at 300 kilometers a second. That's not how it works in the solar system. Mercury moves at like 43 kilometers a second, and Neptune moves at like 5 kilometers a second. So something is going on. The theory is that explains not just
the dark, not just the observations of the galaxy clusters and the individual galaxies themselves, but it turns out also to explain large-scale structure formation. It turns out to explain the patterns of fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. It turns out to explain a whole host of other observations. Is what if there were, in addition to all the normal matter, this other form of matter that didn't interact with light? We call it dark matter, although if we were better namers, we would have called it invisible matter, because it's not dark. It doesn't absorb light or look black. It's just light doesn't interact with it at all. As far as we can tell, it only interacts gravitationally. So that's where the idea of dark matter comes from, and how it applies to spiral galaxies, clusters of galaxies, and realistically on all scales.
You mentioned Fritz Zwicky, and if I recall correctly, in your book, you make a remark that if only people glommed onto his idea right away, it would have sped up the process of understanding a lot of things, including dark matter, by four decades.
You know, the spiral galaxy observation that I told you about, that came around in the 1970s with Vera Rubin. Mm-hmm. And her observations were great. Like, that was a huge thing, and it really led to the idea of dark matter being taken seriously as a serious research topic. Fritz Zwicky was kind of a maverick of a guy. He said a lot of things that were true, and he said a lot more things that actually were kind of crazy. But he was never afraid to try. He was never afraid to throw something wild out there. The things he threw out there was this idea of dark matter based on the coma cluster observations. And for some reason, even though he came out with this factor of 160 difference, people just seem to always assume, like, you know what? It's got to be missing normal matter that makes up the difference. It's got to be, and don't worry about it. It'll pan out. And people would be like, well, you know, we do the observations, and it seems like this mismatch is real, and it's real in other clusters, and it's – people really didn't bother researching into it. They just sort of assumed it would pan out. And I think that if people had said, hey – this is a real problem, we could have started down the road of investigating dark matter much, much sooner. Fritz Zwicky found this in 1933. So yeah, it's not a stretch to say we could have gotten a 40-year head start on the dark matter problem from where we actually did. So it's important to investigate ideas where the observations and the theory don't match up. But it's also hard to know which observations do you trust and which ones actually will turn out over time to not hold up all that much. So it's up to science to investigate it, but resources and number of scientists and interests among scientists are limited. But it does make you wonder what we're missing out on right now due to our own inherent biases.
Well, if you had a TARDIS for, say, an hour, you could go back in time to any place in time and have a conversation with a historical scientist with your current knowledge, that we could talk them into believing something that they didn't know in order to maximize the rate at which we came to understanding our universe at the level we do today. Who would you talk to? What would you tell them?
Well, that gives me an agenda that I wouldn't necessarily have. I mean, if... So let me answer the question I'd rather answer first, which is if I had a time machine and I could go back in time for an hour to talk to a famous scientist, I would go back to the 16th century, and I would talk to Fermat, and I would ask him in an hour what he wanted to write in the margin of that paper that wouldn't fit. Because, you know, he had this idea for Fermat's last theorem that, you know, no one was able to solve until Wiles solved it in the 90s with hundreds and hundreds of pages of a proof using advanced mathematics that hadn't even been developed then. So I would want to know, what was Fermat going to write? I would want to know, what was his proposed solution to Fermat's last theorem? Uh-huh. So that's what I would do if I had a TARDIS. As far as if I were to go back in time and talk to a scientist and convince them of, oh man, if you knew this, what could we arrive at? What could we derive? What could we learn? What what could we get you excited about? I'm not really sure there's any one thing that one super influential person could have glommed onto that would have changed the direction of the field. At a really fundamental level, though, I would say maybe the most exciting thing I could have done is if I were to take the quantum field theory we know today, quantum field theory as we know it, if I could have gone back in time to Dirac in 1930, when Dirac proposed his quantum theory of the electron, which is really the birth of quantum field theory. He didn't know what he was doing. He was ridiculed as crazy for proposing that the electron had a counterpart that was just like it but positive and had the same mass. And we know now that that's antimatter. That was a brand new thing. And a lot of people have said that Dirac went crazy after nobody believed him about antimatter. I think being able to go back in time and show Dirac, hey, here is modern quantum field theory, maybe we could have gotten an extra head start on that, because quantum field theory wasn't really developed in earnest until about 20 years later. And I think with all that we've learned about particle physics since then, getting a real deep start on that, it would have been great. But also, I don't know that going back in time and teaching people all of that would have made that much of a difference. If you had shown Newton the mathematics and the physics of Einstein, would he have bought into it for an hour? Would he have cared?
I think that's a good point. I think your idea is good. I think you would have to match the knowledge to where the person is at when you meet them. I thought about this question earlier today, and I've been thinking about it all day. And one answer I had in my mind is going back and, the old idea of, what if we go and kill Hitler? It would change the world. What if you went and did something that changed history enough that the Dark Ages never happened? So you're not talking to a scientist. Maybe you're talking to somebody, but you're just you're interfering with a multi-century long hiatus in scientific progress of scientific thinking. But since it's a TARDIS and it's bigger on the inside, I would bring back, this is cheating, but I would bring back really good telescope technology to the ancient Greeks.
That's
a whole different premise.
That's maybe an interesting answer, because if you can see things, especially if you know where things were, if you can backtrack and say where things were 2,000, 2,500 years ago, what could you show them in the sky that would blow their mind? Could you show them comets? Could you show them Uranus and Neptune? Could you show them other spiral galaxies? You'd have to bring back a telescope that was at least about 6 feet in diameter for them to see that, by the way. But right. If you could do that, if you could bring one of those back, they would be able to see spiral galaxies in the sky with their own eyes through that eyepiece.
Yeah, and then you're not wrestling with people's preconceptions or ideas. You're just giving them a tool that even if the person you give it to doesn't really do something with it, somebody will eventually start collecting data and start making observations, and who knows what will happen after that.
Assuming that that doesn't go the way of, anything from the works of Aristarchus of Samos, who proposed heliocentrism in the 3rd century BC, but that was lost to history, or the Library of Alexandria, which burned down. Right. So, it's always fun to, speculate on if I could go back and meddle with history, how would the present be different today? But, Greg, you're an anthropologist. You know that coming up with that answer is
ridiculous. Yeah.
At least as much an exercise in fantasy as it is in reality.
Right. Well, I'd make a stop on the way back and stop the fire in the Library of Alexandria as well.
Sure, you've got an hour.
Yeah. Now, how come that's not a Doctor Who episode? I don't know.
But there was this movie that was made, Gods Must Be Crazy, that takes place in South Africa, where somebody that's prehistoric in a sense runs across a Coke bottle and has no idea what it's for. And so they take their preconceived notions about what they might be for, and it leads to a whole bunch of problems, including the fact that it must have been a gift from the gods. So I would wonder if a telescope taken back to the Greeks might have totally confused them, and they wouldn't have used it what you intended for them to use it for.
I don't know. That was a very sad movie, Gods Must Be Crazy. It was funny in a lot of ways, but also very, very tragic. You know, all of ancient Greek history is mired in this like layers and layers of tragedy. So I don't know if you know this, but I used to be a classics major. Like I actually have my bachelor's in classics. So yeah, Greek history was a fun little, I don't know whether to call it a hobby of mine, but I like it a whole lot. But, you know, I think you have to recognize that what we think of as this intellectual cradle of civilization, of where science got its start, it was really just a few people who did some amazing things and wrote it down and had that writing preserved, which is why we know this. As far as I know, the very first science experiment that was done by Empedocles, which is a proof that air takes up space. He took a clepsydra, which is a water thief, which is basically a hollowed-out gourd with holes poked in the bottom and a hole up top that you can put your thumb over. So what you do is you submerge the whole thing in water so that it fills up with water. You put your thumb over the hole on the top and you lift it up, and the water doesn't fall out of the bottom. Now, the reason the water doesn't fall out of the bottom is because it would have to create a vacuum inside the gourd, and it's energetically unfavorable for it to do so. You know, the air pressure is too great, et cetera, et cetera. They didn't know any of that, but they used this as a proof to show that air, even when there's no wind, takes up space, because something must be pushing up against those holes to keep the water from running out. And if you take your thumb off, the water does in fact come running out, and the air pushing it isn't sufficient. So it's kind of interesting to see how you don't have to have all the answers in science in order to draw some good scientific conclusions about something you do have answers about.
You know, when my daughter was little, she asked me if the Easter Bunny was real. And I said to her, what difference would it make if the Easter Bunny is real? And she said, it would make it a lot easier to believe in Santa Claus if the Easter Bunny was real. And I'm wondering if dark matter made it easier to take the step into understanding and accepting the existence of dark energy, which is a different phenomenon than dark matter, but it's even stranger in some ways.
I don't know really anything about the psychology of it, about whether the discovery of dark matter made it easier to accept dark energy. But I do know that the idea of dark energy is actually older than the idea of dark matter. You know, dark energy is this idea that there is energy inherent to space itself. And if you look at all the different cosmological possibilities for what could have been in our universe, right? If you don't ask about what's actually there, if you look at what are some different options for what could have been in an expanding isotropic and homogeneous universe that obeyed the laws of general relativity, you can have matter and you can have radiation and you can have neutrinos and you can have dark matter and you can have topological defects like magnetic monopoles, which are point defects, or you can have cosmic strings, which are one-dimensional defects, or domain walls, which are two-dimensional defects, etc. Or you can have energy inherent to space itself, what we call a cosmological constant.
Now let's do this, Heath, and in a way of leading up to that, because we don't have a lot of time left. We've got about 10 minutes. I was wondering if we could go through the stages of creation and leading up to what brought about the idea of dark energy. So since you're writing your blog and your Medium blog and your Forbes are all starts with a bang, well, let's just start with a bang and talk about what happened here to get to where we are now and what we think is going to happen next and how dark energy fits in.
Sure. So let's give you the 3-minute version of our cosmic history of the universe. And this is just going to be what happens and not how we know it in the interest of time. So at some early time, the earliest time we can say, we know the universe was in an inflationary state, which is to say it was full of energy inherent to space itself, and it was expanding at an exponential rate. So something that was a certain distance apart in a tiny amount of time would then be twice as far. And then when that same amount of times passed, it would be four times as far. And then it would be 16 times as far. And then it would be 256 times as far. That's exponential expansion. So, right, it just, it doubles. And then that new thing it is doubles again. And then that new thing it is doubles again. It allows you in something like 10 to the minus 33 seconds to go from something that's the smallest subatomic distance that makes sense to something bigger than the observable universe. This doesn't violate special relativity because there's nothing in the universe. This is empty space itself. At some point, this inflationary state where we are ended, and all of that energy that was in space itself dumped itself into matter and radiation, right? Hot energy whizzing around, smacking into each other. That's what we call the hot Big Bang. Now, if you want to say, where did inflation get its start, right? Very, very beginning. Did it come from a singularity? Was it always inflating? Was there a cyclical state that gave rise to inflation? Was there some pre-existing state that rejuvenated itself and gave rise to inflation? There are lots of possibilities. There are lots of good arguments to be made, but the real answer is we don't know. So if people still refer to this initial singularity that's the birth of space and time, it may have existed. There's a theorem called the Borde-Guth-Vilenkin theorem that says, well, there probably was, but it doesn't necessarily apply, because that's the problem with theorems, is they only apply to your known physics, and we're past the realm of known physics there. So you start with this inflationary state. It ends, and you get the hot Big Bang. And then the universe is expanding and cooling, right? It's because energy has a certain wavelength. That's what light does, radiation does. It has a wavelength that tells you its energy. But as the universe expands, that wavelength stretches so that light cools. So what happens? In order, your unstable particles, you stop being able to create them because you don't have enough energy from E equals mc squared to just make these new particles. So they decay away. And at some point, you wind up with more matter than antimatter. Then you start to form protons and neutrons. It gets cool enough that you don't have a quark gluon plasma anymore. You have individual nucleons. Then your nuclei start to bind together. You start to get these light elements, deuterium, lithium, helium. Then you cool enough that you can make neutral atoms. Your electrons and your nuclei can bind together without getting blasted apart. That happens when the universe is about 380,000 years old. Then you start to get gravitational collapse. These clumps of matter gravitate together, and you start to form the first stars. That happens about 50 to 100 million years after the Big Bang. Then these star clusters merge together, and you get the first galaxy. That happens 200 to 400 million years after the Big Bang. Then you start to form large-scale structures. Your first stars die, go supernova, and start to put heavy elements out into the universe. And you start to get the first rocky planets and the first ingredients for life. After about 9.2 billion years, where you have all of this matter, all of this energy, all of these galaxies that have fallen into clusters or groups or have remained isolated, at 9.2 billion years after the Big Bang, our star and our solar system begins to form. A few billion years before that, at about 7.8 billion years, the matter density has dropped to a low enough amount that we started to notice, hey, there's some other form of energy in the universe. Instead of gravitation trying to pull everything together and slowing the expansion rate down, the expansion rate starts to speed up again. Galaxies that are very distant from us, instead of moving away from us at a slower and slower rate, are moving away faster and faster. That's what dark energy is and where it comes in. And then in our own local group, in our own galaxy, and in our own solar system, we formed the Earth about 50 million years after it formed. Something struck it, and that formed our moon. That was the giant impact hypothesis, which we now know is true since we've been to the moon and we've collected rocks. And we said, holy crap, it's the same stuff we have on Earth, unlike every other planet and their moons. So that happened. And then, you know, you start to get to, hey, we developed life on Earth, which seems to have happened really early. As best as we can tell, life on Earth happened no later than 700 million years into our planet's history, or just 3.8 billion years ago. At some point, life evolved to form multicellular organisms. We've developed sex and the ability to exchange genetic information and pass it on to offsprings. And that's allowed us to encode larger and larger amounts of DNA and have long lifespans and still be resistant to the changes in the environment with the smaller creatures that can adapt and evolve much faster. At some point 550 million years ago, we had the Cambrian explosion where multicellular complex differentiated life took off, and a number of mass extinction events paved the way for smaller, other, more differentiated, more niche-filling creatures to rise to the top. And finally, I'll say as the last thing, about 47 years ago, humans became technologically advanced enough to leave our own planet under our own power. And as far as we know, we became the first species to willingly take ourselves off of our homeworld and land on another when we walked on the moon. So that's the brief history of the entire universe.
Ethan, you were talking about changes in energy and matter density as part of that story. Okay. I would like to know, how far back in time from the present would you have to go on the Earth? So just never mind that the Earth is only, you know, 4 billion years old. Let's pretend it can go back farther. In order to actually have an observable impact on what it would be like to be here, or just on any planet, does that difference in energy or matter density actually matter to someone sitting on a planet within an atmosphere, say 5 billion years ago, 7 billion years ago, or does it stop mattering at some point?
Well, it depends on what you mean in terms of feeling it, right? If you look at the cosmic microwave background, that's the leftover glow from the Big Bang. That's the radiation from when matter first became neutral, you know, when it was 380,000 years old.
Right.
You can look back at that and you would see a different temperature. And in fact, we do. When we look at distant galaxies, distant clusters of galaxies and different gas clouds, we can see that the cosmic microwave background was a different temperature. So that would affect you, for example, when you turn your television with your old rabbit ears to channel 3 and you see that snow on the TV. About 1% of that snow is due to the cosmic microwave background, is due to the Big Bang's leftover glow. So that pattern would be different if you were here on Earth 5 billion years ago. But you wouldn't really start to notice, like, ooh, interstellar space is warm. It's like room temperature. You would have to go back, you know, to when the universe was only a few million years old to experience something like that.
Right. So there's nothing that would that in the last 3.8 billion years that we need to keep track of when we're trying to think about the origin and evolution of life on Earth with respect to energy and matter density in the universe.
Not on a grand cosmic scale.
That's too bad, because that would have been cool if that was a factor to consider. I want to thank you for being on the show. Again, I want to recommend your book, because it really is the modern version of Isaac Asimov's History of the Universe.